The Guardian.
Keep thinking, I mean, you're at the game, like, and go!
Last week, for the second time ever, Science Weekly went out live on Facebook.
Hello, and welcome to this very special edition of Science Weekly.
Joining me in the studio was Professor Brian Cox. As well as the wonderful Robin Ince.
Welcome to you both.
Is that his title now? Do you earn that as an academic accolade? The wonderful.
Robin Ince, the wonderful.
The fabulous Professor Brian Cox and the wonderful Robin Ince. It would sound like I'd had too much coffee, so I thought I should just, you know, meter it out a little.
Also, you don't like being fabulous because it makes you less certain of your existence.
Yes.
And
that's
already a problem with your love of simulation theory.
The duo were here to discuss their new book, and I took questions live from viewers, as well as offering a selection of my own.
Yeah, little more.
Questions included, why is science important for society? What role can comedy play in our seemingly despairing world? And of course, will anyone ever build Northampton on Mars?
So the value of science goes way beyond people just knowing about popularising the fact there are 2 trillion galaxies in the observable universe. That's not what it's about at all. What it's about is a way of thinking that can be tested and makes you humble and lead you to a deeper understanding of something real. And you can do that in politics as well. We don't enough, but you can. So that's why it's important.
Again, going back to that idea of sometimes very simple questions lead to incredible conundrums within our understanding and how much we can refine those ideas to go, this is the nearest definition we have for now.
I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly.
So, co-hosts of The Infinite Monkey Cage on Radio 4, you now have a book out. Here we go. Here it is. How to Build a Universe.
I have to keep saying this. Part one.
Part one.
It's part one. They've put part one far too small. I've picked up people on this because worries me that people will see How to Build a Universe and then they'll be cross. And it's got, what bits of the universe can we get them through? There's some gases, really, aren't there?
Robin.
Very early stage.
Robin, they've also missed out the wonderful. They've got Professor, and they missed out your wonderful.
You have to, yeah. If you rub a coin against it, an old £1 coin, the wonderful bit comes out.
And Robin was very worried because if people get it, and then on the Amazon reviews, they say, well, I couldn't build a universe after reading this book. Robin thought it had to be an introduction.
Yeah.
Where you just build a small...
just start
reality.
Off with a small universe, and then you decide whether you want to be a malevolent god or a benign god. So these are a lot of the choices you can make from this book.
Excellent. Yeah. It's like a choose-your-own-adventure story, but on a large and fabulous scale, in fact. So talk me through, why did you want to write this book? Because you've delved into different bits of the universe in other books before, Brian. So what was this one all about?
It's really a book about the infinite monkey cage and the subjects that we've covered over almost 10 years now, is it?
Yeah.
I think we're on to the 100th episode next
year. Yeah, we were 95th. We've done 95 so far.
Yeah.
It's not bits from the show. They are some of the subjects that we've explored we wanted to... Because basically what happens on the show is we sit down with our producer and co-writer of the book, Sash Alexander Feacham, and in the afternoon we go, we're going to talk about this, this and this. And then the show starts and we only ever talk about that, but not this and this. So every single topic we've done, whether why we know so little about the oceans, whether it is about simulation theory, whether it is about the nature of the brain, we only ever get to part one questions. Yeah, we never get to part two and part three.
And we've had some big... topics that fans keep coming back to, in particular the nature of infinity. So we had a big argument on the episode The Infinite Monkey Cage about infinity and something called Hilbert's Hotel, which is a hotel that even though it can be fully occupied, there are always rooms available. And so that John Lloyd in particular got very, very annoyed about that. And so we've tried to explain in the book what infinity is, why there are different sizes of infinity, which is kind of a counterintuitive idea. So we wanted to address that. The dead strawberry, a very famous argument and debate we've had, which came from me, I think, just whimsically musing on the radio about whether a strawberry's dead or not, by which I meant, what is a seed? What's alive about a seed? Does it metabolize? If so, is there a finite length of time for which it could turn into a plant or whatever, if you put it in the right conditions or not. And it's actually quite a well-researched and sort of debatable subject in astrology.
Whoa! You're talking about the section I put all your books into in Oxford.
Biology. Biology, astrology, I don't know, it was the same.
It's allology.
In biology. About,
so, do you know what? I read your forecast today and it said you were going to make that cock up. Yeah.
I'm a bit tired. But it's very interesting. It becomes interesting. It's about, well, what is a strawberry, actually? It turns out it's not a berry. Because
we've been missold it for years.
It's part of the plant. So it's not a berry. And even the little pits in the strawberry that you think, oh, those are the seeds. They're not. They're the ovaries of the plant and the seeds are inside there. So the book is full of kind of interesting trivia like that.
But it's not, I mean, that's the thing about when this, the moment where Brian just went, but when is a strawberry dead? At that point, you know, that led to about three different shows. And then you start to think about definitions of life and death for a lot of other things. I mean, for instance, you know, there are certain frogs that in hibernation appear to have no life signs whatsoever. And so that then brings in this, at that point of hibernation, well, they're not, surely they're not dead because they're coming back to life. But we can't seem to measure any sense of, you know, activity with it. So this leads to a lot of questions about, you know, definition of life and definition of death. As you know, the moment someone goes, here's a definition of life, someone will then go, no, but hang on, that's a crystal as well. Then someone will go, what about this definition of life? Oh, but that's fire as well. And so those, again, going back to that idea of sometimes very simple questions lead to incredible conundrums within our understanding and how much we can refine those ideas to go, this is the nearest definition we have for now. And a lot of the book is about that. A lot of the book is something that we've talked about a lot in the show, which is, you know, science is not about this is right. It's about saying this is definitely the least wrong version of events we have for the time being. But it's, there's, you know, if you come across with a better idea that has been tested and is testable, then it may well turn out that's the next stage.
It's these kinds of ideas that Robin and Brian attempt to unpick in their wonderful radio show and now in their book, Making Science Accessible to All. Makes people sort of. What I wanted to know, though, is whether this popularisation of science can go too far. It's a debate that garnered headlines as a result of a 2016 paper from the University of Münster in Germany, which argued that science popularisation inclines laypeople to underrate their dependence on experts. It's something I first put to Brian.
The point about science is that, and I'm not the first to say this, Carl Sagan argued it very powerfully, science is one of the necessary foundations of our civilization. It's not sufficient, there are other foundations, but science is one of the necessary foundations. So in a democracy, for a democracy to function properly, the citizens need to know something about the foundations of that civilization. So if science is a priesthood, it is literally practiced by people in ivory towers who are thought to be some kind of strange individuals that have access to something that us mere mortals do not have, then democracy doesn't function properly. So the idea that we would choose to restrict access to a particular sort of idea, that the scientific ideas. Why? Because people feel that by democratizing knowledge, you somehow make society more likely to be irrational. I can't see that's true at all. It cannot be the case. I think it's the reverse, actually. I think that if science is perceived as a preserve of a select few, then I think when we say, well, given our best understanding of a particular problem, be it climate change or public health policy or whatever it is, if we say, well, this is our best understanding, and people have no connection with it or familiarity with that body of knowledge that is science, then how are they to take it seriously?
Yeah.
It's just because a few people are telling me, the few people at Oxford and Cambridge are telling me to do this stuff. That it seems to me to be nonsensical. Yeah.
So it's just
argument.
Important to engage people and to actually give them the understanding to make their own, to make their decisions.
Learn who to, because this is part of, I think, the problem. We have an extremely complex society. You know, there's the old Feynman line about the fact the boundaries of our ignorance grow on a daily basis. So unfortunately, whether people, you know, they might not like it, but you have to eventually go, I am not going to be able to be an expert on how to remove my appendix or indeed on climate change. But what I do need to learn is, first of all, who are the people I can trust most? I need to know why I can trust them, and I need to know what are the questions, what are the best questions I can ask them to work out who are those people. Who are the right people? So that's the problem. We have such an enormous problem. The idea that you can, this is a problem we have quite often, is someone goes to they see a paper and they read the one paper and they go, oh, well, that refutes this idea.
Yeah,
but
okay.
Most papers are read for people who have a huge background in that. So I think, I don't think it's to teaching science or popularizing science that you end up with that kind of possibility of falling into dogma. Because I think if you teach it properly, then you go, this is extremely complex. It will take a very, very long time to understand this. But it doesn't mean you should shy away from it. And you shouldn't shy away from asking questions. You should not merely bow down to the priesthood.
This idea of what's the most valuable thing about science has been discussed a lot. And I've recently been looking back to some work that was done in the 1950s. In particular, there's a very famous essay by Richard Feynman called The Value of Science, in which he says that the most valuable thing that science has given us is a way of thinking. He calls it a satisfactory philosophy of ignorance, which is what Robin's been talking about, where it's the idea that you change your mind and you understand it's a great thing to do based on new evidence that comes in. So a philosophy of ignorance. But also, I came across the Reith Lectures by Robert Oppenheimer, which he gave in 1953. And they were frowned upon at the time because he didn't talk about the atom bomb. And people thought he was going to do his greatest hits, you know, the mushroom cloud. But he talked about science and society and really this question. And this is from the perspective of someone who ended, I think, being very disturbed about the way that knowledge has been used. I think he was not entirely uncomfortable with the first bomb on Hiroshima. You can argue that that brought a swifter end to the war in the Pacific. But he was appalled by the second use at Nagasaki. He was also hounded out by McCarthy. Mm-hmm. And so these very volatile ideas. And he gave these lectures and he said that the way that we are taught, we are forced to think scientifically can be used by analogy in politics and in wider discourse. So, for example, the way we're forced to think about quantum mechanics. So we are forced to think of a particle that can sometimes behave like a little billy ball and sometimes like a wave. And it's not only that you have to hold those two ideas in your head at the same time, it is necessary to do so in order to build a complete picture of that natural system. You are forced to do it. It's called complementarity in Niels Bohr's language. So he said, if you think about politics and the way that society is organized, there are axioms such as the freedom of the individual or the collective requirements of society. Now, if you're axiomatic, you might be a libertarian and say freedom is the thing and I'll grudgingly give up a bit for the community. Or if you're a Marxist, let's say, or a communist, as Oppenheimer spoke about in the 50s, you might say, well, the collective is all there is and really individual freedom isn't there. And he's saying, no, science teaches us that you have to be humble and careful to not be axiomatic and say, this is the way that it is. And I think this goes back to your original question. So the value of science goes way beyond people just knowing about popularizing the fact there are 2 trillion galaxies in the observable universe. That's not what it's about at all. What it's about is a way of thinking that can be tested and makes you humble and leads you to a deeper understanding of something real. And you can do that in politics as well. We don't enough, but you can. So that's why it's important.
Looking at this complex relationship between science, scientists and society, we next went to a question from one of our Facebook Live viewers.
Maybe pushing their politics.
Nicholas Bates wanted to know what both Brian and Robin thought about the idea of popular figures in science pushing their political beliefs. Do they do this? And if so, should they?
Can I ask you, I presume that perhaps what Nicholas has said, that very often comes up with climate change. And that is, you know, that it's been made political. That's the thing, which is the actual subject itself. I think it has political ramifications, though it actually starts from scientific
questions. In that case, you have to separate the modelling of the climate, which is the best you can do. So you ask the question, what the climate will be like in 100 years. The only way we can do that is make measurements now, build models and try and test them, which you can do by running them back in time, or you can run them forward. And that's the best you can do. So there's the best advice, as it were. It is true, then, that there's the policy response to that advice. And there's a lot of debate in the policy community about how far scientists should get involved in trying to drive the policy responses to the science. It's true, you can argue either way. On the broader point, I mean, he may be referring to the fact that should scientists express an opinion at all about anything? And the answer is yes, because they're voters and taxpayers and they're citizens with equal rights. And so they should be free to express opinions however they wish. But of course, it's necessary to be very careful if you're in the framework of giving scientific advice to government And then you have to be careful. So the line between the advice and the policy decisions, it can be blurred. And that is something of concern.
Another concern brought up by a Facebook viewer was the future of the human race, something we'll hear about after this short break.
So we're going to start mining asteroids. We have the ability to do that now. We will establish bases on the moon and then Mars. So if we can get through the next couple of decades and we begin to move off the planet, I think that then secures our future.
We'll also hear about the role that comedy can play, both for science and beyond.
We need as much as possible to find as many different ways as talking about as many different ideas as possible, making them approachable, making people less fearful of approaching them.
We'll be right back. Before we kick off again, I wanted to point you in the direction of another podcast here at The Guardian. It's called Brexit Means, and as the name would suggest, it attempts to finally find out what exactly Brexit does mean, apart from, of course, Brexit. So if you feel like delving into the nitty-gritty of Britain's exit from the EU, be sure to join John Henley and his experts on The Guardian's Brexit Means. To find out more, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search Brexit Means on your favourite podcast app. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Nicola Davis. Before the break, we heard from Brian Cox and Robin Ince about their new book, How to Build a Universe. Recorded live on The Guardian's Facebook page, they tackled the potential issues of the overpopularization of science. They also explored the complex role that science and scientists can play within our societies. It's a point highlighted by the next question from one of our Facebook viewers, Clive Smith, who asked whether Brian and Robin are optimistic about the future of humanity. When seen through the lens of an infinite universe, he asks, is it all a bit pointless?
Yes, it is all ultimately pointless. Therein, though, actually in this book, at the end, there's an essay on that where we both muse on this. What should we make of the fact that we have a finite existence and we're a finite part of a probably or quite possibly infinite universe? The point is that's the challenge that I think has generated not only a lot of scientific debate, but most art since art began, is the finite nature of human existence is one of the great catalysts, I think, for thought.
It's really one of the greatest problems of being human, isn't it? To be aware, to have the ability to plan ahead, but within that ability that has evolved, we are also aware of the fact that it ends. I always find, generally in physics, both particle and theoretical physicists, I've found you lot are always quite kind of relaxed about death, it seems to me, because you see that at least the atom, you know, kind of keeps the recycling of the atom, at least for the, you know, the length of the life of the universe. Whereas biologists, I find, can sometimes be in a bit more of a hurry because they see molecular death, and that's why I think, that's my theory on the difference in the...
To the first bit, am I optimistic about the human race? I made a documentary recently on commercial spaceflight, and I think it is true that over the next 20 years or so, we have the opportunity to become a genuinely multiplanetary civilization, or to lay those foundations. So we're going to start mining asteroids. We have the ability to do that now. We will establish bases on the moon and then Mars. So if we can get through the next couple of decades and we begin to move off the planet, I think that then secures our future. It's whether we can take that opportunity. That we now have got the technology to do it. And Elon Musk actually has said, the thing is, be logical. If you want to destroy the human race, you want it on one planet. Therefore, if you don't want to destroy it, you want it on more than one planet, which is true. That is not now science fiction.
Yeah.
So I am optimistic if we can make it through the next few decades.
I also think there's a thing about pointlessness, which is, isn't it, if we are in charge of at least attempting to create our own point individually, if there was just one point and you were saying that this is the point, you go, oh, that's the point. There's no, it's suddenly,
that's it,
the
that's
variety
your
of possibilities is gone. All of those things, you know, the point to me seems to be, you know, you want to try and live as good a life as possible and make life for those around you and those you love as good as possible. And it may well be finite, but you are now in charge, or appear to be in charge, let's not get into those neuroscientific debates, to try and just make the best life possible for as many people as possible.
It says it here. What did it say? It says cosmology. Cosmology is the ultimate exercise of reason, and our reason confirms what we have always known deep down. Whether human or star, life is short, precious, and fleeting. The universe will spend an eternity in darkness after a brief period of light, and we are most fortunate to have had this opportunity to discover this deep truth.
Robin, actually speaking there about sort of dark times, it seems that truth and facts are under assault in a way that we have never sort of really come across before. How can comedy help us kind of find a way back to...
Well, it's very difficult. I mean, it's not just... It's finding different ways, because we are bombarded. At the moment, we have... I do think there is too much information, and working out the information that, you know, to actually get out and work out why you believe what you believe. There are so many things that you can actually just accept to go, that is very handy for my dogma. That is very handy to my dogma. You can see why people may become, you know, more tribal in those things. But comedy just allows you to... You can play around with stuff. Because you are an irresponsible individual, because you are a fool, you can play around with ideas, you know, in the shows that I do, whether, I mean, in the current show that I'm doing, where I do end up talking about mental health and death and things like that, and even, for instance, talking about suicide in the show, I mean, that comes down to the fact that a woman who had lost a child to suicide said, I want comedians to talk about these things more so these things stop becoming taboo. Mm-hmm. So I think it does allow us, in our foolish and preposterous way, we can go, right, here are some ideas that hopefully are more approachable than in some of the, well, more austere environment. We need as much as possible to find as many different ways as talking about as many different ideas as possible, making them approachable, making people less fearful of approaching them.
And what makes science and comedy such a good match?
Was just loads to talk about. You know, if you're writing a routine about a supermarket, eventually you've run out of all different things to talk about supermarkets. When it comes to air travel, eventually you run out of things you can say about air travel. When it comes to everything the universe contains, both that we know for reasonable certainty, imagined ideas as well, multiverse theory, many worlds theory, is a lot of
You asked about what the point of the universe is. So Robin has said to a comedian, it's just a source of material.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Which I suppose it is.
For all of us, it's just a source of material.
General,
isn't it?
Yeah.
So here's a question from one of our Facebook viewers, Andrea Patterson, who says that she has a 3-year-old at home. Do you have any advice for how best to make science a part of his daily life in a way that he can feel excited and inspired by?
It's all play, isn't it? I mean, that to me is the starting point, is when you show a child, you show them a different way that something reacts. You show, it, you know, at that stage, it is that fun of when things explode, when things go flying around a room, yes. You know, whether it's balloons, all of those different things just start, you know, even when they, you know, that terrible moment of dropping the ice cream. And I remember that with my son, we always used it, if the ice cream fell, it would be, no, gravity. And then just, you know, just little mucking around ideas. Yeah. You know, when reading something that I read when Brian and I were on tour, I would read from Charles Darwin's book All About Earthworms, which has lots of fun experiments where
that's
Charles
in the book.
Darwin it's in the book, I think,
well.
There so we've got, you know, it's just having, let's stop, let's look at this thing,
yeah,
why is that doing that? And it's, you know, the adventure, it's not, you aren't going to be able to instill necessarily, you know, very the deep ideas of in terms of equation understanding,
yeah.
But curiosity.
Making extraordinary.
Yeah, so, why is that doing that? Why is that leaf done that? Why does that look like that? You know, why are these strawberries mortal?
As well as inspiring this kind of childlike curiosity about the world, what Brian and Robin's book does so well is tell the stories of the scientists behind the discoveries.
The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences has decided to award the 2017 Nobel Prize in Physics with one half to Rainer Weiss, and the other half jointly to Barry C. Barish and Kip S. Thorne for decisive contributions to the LIGO detector and the observation of gravitational waves.
And it was this topic of human stories that we turned to next, specifically the heroes of the recent Nobel Prizes.
I just wanted to ask you there, Brian, I mean, when it comes to the Nobel Prizes, you know, all of the winners for science this year, so the physiology or medicine, physics and chemistry, they were all men and they were all white and they were all of a certain age. And I just wondered, are the Nobel Prizes, not only in terms of diversity or lack of, but in terms of the fact that they honour individuals, generally speaking, rather than big teams, are they still, do they still do the right job that they're supposed to be doing?
Yes, it's a good question. There's a specific prize for physics, so I'll address them separately. In the case of the physics prize this year, I remember I went to LIGO in 2008, I think. And I remember at the time, those three, I think, really pioneered that experiment and fought for it and fought for it and got the funding and fought for the developing the theory of it under quite intense criticism at the time, because many people thought it was nonsense and you just couldn't detect gravitational waves. So my view is that that award to those three individuals was entirely right. And I know that there are many people, so Martin Rees and others, who've argued that you should give it to collaborations. And it may well be, that's may well be true in the modern world. You know, you get these vast, like the LHC collaborations, and CERN, thousands
huge
of people,
numbers of researchers,
loads of engineers working on it. But I think in that specific case, actually, I think it was the correct thing to do, because I know those people personally, and I know that they pushed it and pushed it and pushed it and stood up for it. And there wouldn't be a LIGO without those three. There would not be that experiment, I'm sure. Your other question, though, is a good one. In part, it's reflective of a failure that happened many decades ago. Because you're right, the Nobel Prizes tend to be awarded to people late in their careers. And so what you're seeing is a snapshot of science as it was in the 1970s, probably. And so when the talent pool was not accessed. So and you're right to say it's white, male. The reason that they tend to be older in life, it tend to be, is because people tend to get rewarded later.
Yeah.
So what I think is true, it's certainly true in life sciences, not as true in physics at the moment, is that as the cohort of scientists becomes more diverse, then the Nobel Prizes of the future will be more diverse. So I think we're seeing a time lag, and it's almost like taking a photograph of the world as it was in the 1970s. In general, if I've got a minute, but very quickly, I was at a conference last week in Estonia, actually. It was an EU science conference, Future of Science in the EU, and EU funding. And in Ireland, and I think I'll get it right, but they did a very interesting thing with their fellowship schemes, which is, so they'd noticed that in I think science in general, but certainly in physics, there was of order a 25% success rate for women and a 75% success rate for men in the award of these fellowships. And so what they did, they had a quota system for each university. And I think it was something like each university could submit six people for the award. And that was it, for the fellowship award. So they said, no, you can submit 12, but only six maximum can be male. And what they found is then they assessed the applications blind and awarded them a merit only, and ended up with 50-50.
Really?
Female, male.
Yeah, yeah.
So the smart thing, in my opinion, is that's affirmative action, but it's not disadvantaging anyone. There always could have been a maximum of six men, and there could still be
a maximum of six men,
If the university wanted to submit 12, they could, but a maximum of six men. And it solved the problem in 1 year.
That's fascinating.
Right? So that's in Ireland. So I think those details are correct, but roughly speaking, that's what they did, and it worked. So ultimately, I think that sort of idea is smart. It doesn't disadvantage anyone, but it encourages it works.
I'm going to ask a final question, a roundup question. So obviously our listeners are raring to go and buy your new book. But if you decided to sign up on a trip to Mars, as we talked about earlier, which bit of literature, and it can be scientific or it could be fiction, and which musical track would you take with you?
Oh, that's...
I would take...
You're not allowed to take D-Ream, Brian.
No, I certainly wouldn't. I would take one of the great physics textbooks, and the reason is, if you only take one book, then you want to take something that challenges you intellectually for many years. And actually, the great gravitation book is Meisner, Thorne and Wheeler. Thorne is Kip Thorne, who got the Nobel Prize for the gravitational waves. But he wrote this. It's this thing. If you're listening on audio, you can't see this, but I'm with my hands. I'm
doing large.
It's a very, very big doorstep type book of many. It's thousands of pages long, just called Gravitation. And if you can understand that book, then you understand a great deal, pretty much everything about general relativity. Yeah. And so that would keep me amused for years.
And what will you be listening to whilst you're thumbing this tome?
I would take the entire works of Jim Akalila's Live Scientific.
Yeah.
That's what I'd do. I'd listen to Jim.
Hope Jim's listening to this.
Yeah.
Robin, what about
you?
I
would take Alan Moore's Jerusalem, which is an incredible piece of work, which is his kind of a history of Northampton, a fictional history with a lot of it. It's a huge book. It's longer than the Old Testament. I've read it already, but it's one of those fictions where there are so many ideas and it's so richly written that you would just be constantly able to look out the window and have another little thing. And the other thing is, I would take anything by Nick Cave in The Bad Seeds, because I went to see him yet again in the last few weeks, and I think that the humanity and the beauty of Nick Cave in The Bad Seeds work is just a very beautiful thing.
I'd take Rio by Duran Duran.
There we go.
Because I love that album.
Oh, that's got that. That's like the end of Dark Star, which as it explodes, there we see you surfing on the debris while Rio plays in the background.
We're going to do these things. I'm going to take this big book that's going to teach me about the universe and nature so I can do things on Mars and build things. He's going to be able to, at best, recreate the history of Northampton.
Yeah. Well, what that is, I think... Do you know what? I reckon if you were able to create Northampton on Mars, that would be pretty impressive. There are you trying to make your potatoes or whatever, like in the Martian.
Where would the
I've built lovely Northampton,
that,
the shopping area.
Where would the M1 go?
Well, I haven't worked that out yet, because I've got to read the book again to work out where I'm going to place the M1. But it only has to be the M1. Actually, the M1's no good for Northampton anyway.
Isn't it?
Is there going to be a Northampton on Mars?
Well, with my ambition, yes, there will be.
Have you recreated?
I might start off with Daventry.
Will it be new Northampton?
I'm looking at Google Maps now while you wrap up, just to check, because I'm sure that...
No, I think you're right, the M1, but I don't have to build the M1 because it doesn't go through Northampton.
I'm going to draw this to a close now before we end up going around Northampton's roundabout.
Because the height of my ambition. My ambition is to build Northampton on
You can
on
come
Mars.
Off the M1 and you can go up the A... What's that? The A46. Is it A46?
No, I'll do the A46, but I'm not doing the M1.
A45. I reckon it's about 10 miles off the M1.
Yeah, I can do the A45.
Special thanks this week to Professor Brian Cox and Robin Ince. We'll include a link to their latest book, How to Build a Universe, in the episode's description on the Guardian website. We'll also include the link to the full video from our Facebook page, where you can hear more of the conversation.